This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri, in for Bob Kinzel. The countdown to Iowa and New Hampshire felt like a long time coming. But once those voters had their say, the primary season just got started. Now, weekly results are coming in from primaries and caucuses around the country. There's still a lot of ballot casting, caucusing, and delegate choosing to go before the two major parties nominate their candidate at their respective conventions. In the past week, Democrats in Maine, Michigan, and Mississippi had their say. In addition to the latter two, Republicans in Puerto Rico, Hawaii, and Idaho also got to vote. Today, we're going to get an update on the latest developments in the campaign, focusing on the most recent results in the Democratic contest between Senator Bernie Sanders and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Joining us to help us make sense of the picture right now is Bert Johnson, chair of the Middlebury College Political Science Department, and Gabriel DeBenedetti, a reporter with Politico who covers the Democratic presidential candidates. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks, great to be here.
All right, so let's look at this week's biggest story, which was Michigan. The last polls leading up to Tuesday had Hillary Clinton ahead by 20-plus points. Bernie Sanders wins by a point and a half. So, Bert Johnson, how big is that turnaround for Bernie?
That's a pretty big turnaround, and I've got to say this election season has been great for political scientists because we get a lot of interviews, and it's not been great because we tend often to be wrong. So with that as a disclaimer, let me try to explain what happened. I think what happens when a lot of polls are off like that is that something's going wrong with their estimates of who's going to turn out to vote. So there's something the matter with the turnout modeling that's going on in Michigan. And it's a tough job to build a good turnout model, especially if you don't have a lot of historical information about who's going to turn out to vote and who's not going to turn out.
Gabriel, what did you see as the problem with the, or not with the numbers, but why they came up so vastly different from the final results?
Well, you know, I think that's exactly right. You know, the turnout models were not necessarily where they should have been, but I think what was also a big X factor here that no one really knew how to account for was the fact that Michigan has an open primary, which means that independents can vote in either side. And, you know, Sanders has done particularly well in those. You look at New Hampshire as an example of that. But in Michigan, particularly with the rise of Donald Trump, who won the Republican side there, it was not necessarily clear to pollsters how a lot of these people were going to break, you know, whether Democrats were going to vote Republican, independents voting Democrat. And clearly what you saw was a lot of independents breaking for Sanders in a way that was not necessarily anticipated.
Now, I understand the youth vote was underrepresented in the polls. There was a much higher turnout than expected, despite there being a lot of the Michigan college students. Michigan State, for instance, which has 55,000 students, were away on spring break. How big a factor was that, Bert?
I think it's a very big factor. And when you look at Bernie Sanders' coalition, just generally speaking, he tends to do extremely well with young people. So the fact that they turned out at unexpectedly high rates is a lot to do with why he won the other day.
Gabriel, does he harness this momentum? And if so, how?
Well, that's the hope. You know, what we're hearing a lot from people that are associated with the Sanders campaign is that they're really assuming or hoping that their win in Ohio or in Michigan proves that they can win in other similar states. Some of the next ones to vote include Ohio, Missouri, and Illinois. Those are not necessarily similar, but there are states that have some, you know, some demographic features that resemble Michigan, and of course, some of them are nearby. So you're going to see a lot of these similar arguments. Had they not won Michigan, it would be a much harder case to make that they would be competitive in a place like Ohio or in Illinois. But the fact that they are competitive in Michigan, you know, it was obviously a close race. They only won by 2 points. But the fact that they were able to pull that off and win that suggests to the Sanders people that Ohio and Illinois and Missouri are all within reach.
One of our listeners, John, wrote in to say one big reason that polling can be inaccurate is because it's a moving target. In Michigan and in other states coming up, people are just getting to know Bernie. They are constantly making up their minds or changing their minds right up to voting time. So unless the polling can keep up with those changes, it's not going to be accurate. In New Hampshire, for example, candidate preferences were established early. They didn't change very much over time and therefore were more accurate. Listeners, you can join the conversation now about the primaries. What do you think about Bernie Sanders and turning it around in Michigan? Will that help him win more primaries going forward? Or do you think that he doesn't have a chance to overcome the big delegate count in Hillary Clinton's favor. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts at the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Now, as big as Michigan was, let's take it together with Michigan and Mississippi on Tuesday. Hillary Clinton actually comes out ahead with a net of 5 delegates. So as big as Michigan was it big enough? Gabriel?
Well, if you listen to the Clinton campaign, of course they're going to say no. The answer to this question is multi-parted. I mean, the reality is the Clinton campaign walked away from voting on that day with more delegates than they came into it with and a higher delegate lead than before, which is ultimately what this thing is all about. They came away with 20-plus delegates net at the end of the day. But the Sanders people are saying, okay, that may be the case, but the very fact that we were able to win Michigan after being down by 20 and in this state that is not necessarily doesn't look demographically like other states that Sanders has won so far suggests that he's able to compete much more seriously moving forward. So, yes, Clinton got closer to the nomination, and we should say that Sanders' path forward is still very narrow. But the reality is that his win in Michigan suggests to a lot of people that support him that, you know, he doesn't need to go away anytime soon because he can seriously compete in some of these bigger states later on.
Bert, what do you take from this week?
I think that's basically right. I think he's shown a remarkable ability to broaden his natural coalition. So picking up in the order of 30% of African-American votes in Michigan, for example, is a significant accomplishment, even if he didn't win the African-American vote. So, and of course, overcoming a polling deficit of 15 percentage points does suggest to Bernie Sanders supporters that maybe anything's possible. But I agree that the route forward is narrow. I think what he needs to be doing now is not just winning, but winning big in order to make up the delegate deficit that he still has with Hillary.
Well, let's look at that deficit. Right now, the pledged delegate count is Hillary Clinton 760, Bernie Sanders 546. On paper, it doesn't seem insurmountable. But Gabriel, is it?
Well, you know, what Bert said is correct, which is that he's going to have to start winning by really large margins in some of these big states, and that's just not what the polling show right now. The polling shows right now. So things would the dynamic of the race would have to change pretty dramatically for him to be on target to win the nomination in terms of delegates just alone. They believe that the superdelegates, which are a separate issue entirely, will switch over time as it becomes clear that Sanders, you know, is the right option if it turns out that way. But things still have to change pretty dramatically for him to be, you know, on track. The Clinton people may not be thrilled with the way that he is sticking around, but the reality is that if things keep going as they currently are, Hillary Clinton will get the nomination.
And Bert, you looking at the pledged delegate count, insurmountable or not?
Not insurmountable, mathematically, but I agree that it would require something big to turn this race around because he needs to win big. Now, if the rules were like they are on the Republican side, where we've got some winner-take-all states coming up, mm-hmm. then there would be a greater chance for Bernie to pick up a lot of delegates very quickly. But that's just not the case on the Democratic side, where it's all proportional.
Listeners, you can join the conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. We do have Bob from Walden calling in. Bob, thanks for calling Vermont Edition. What's your question or comment?
Yes, I'd just like to say that public opinion is greatly influenced by what commentators, such as your guests, say. When they say that Hillary Clinton has the superdelegate lead, what they neglect to say is that those delegates are not cast in stone for her. They can change their mind just as they did in the Clinton-Obama race.
Yep.
And secondly, when pollsters say that Clinton has a commanding lead, that influences voters' choice. So I wish that they could, your commentators and others in the media, can find a different way of expressing the current situation without that foregone conclusion that Clinton is going to win.
Bob, thanks. You make an excellent point. Now, we've been talking just about pledged delegates so far, haven't brought up the superdelegates, which are heavily right now in Hillary Clinton's favor, but let's talk about them. Bert Johnson, the superdelegate count, very lopsided in favor of Hillary. What weight do you assign to the superdelegate count?
Not much weight at all. And there, Bob is absolutely right. The superdelegates we should not really be paying attention to right now because they can change their minds, and historically, they do. The great thing about democracy is that politicians tend to be sort of cowards and will go which way the people go. So it's very much like in Vermont when we have a contested governor's race that gets thrown to the legislature. Theoretically, the legislature can vote any way they want on who could become governor, but usually they go with what the plurality of the voters say.
Gabriel, how important do you see the superdelegates?
Well, I think that's right. And it's not only what Bert's just said, but the reality is that neither campaign wants this to come down to superdelegates. The Clinton campaign doesn't want to win solely based on what, you know, has been described as the party's elites. They want to win this outright with the pledged delegates. But to the caller's point, the lead in pledged delegates that Clinton has right now is larger than any lead that Obama had during the entire time that he was running against Clinton. So it is fair to say that it's a large lead in pledged delegates, not just superdelegates. That said, obviously, it's not an enormous lead. It's still, you know, within play. But the reality is, because of the proportional system, it's going to be very difficult for Sanders to catch up. That's just the objective truth.
Well, Gabriel, so Sanders needs a comeback. Are there examples in past primaries when a candidate seemed to have this kind of an uphill climb and was able to win the nomination in the end?
It's a bit difficult to make historical comparisons at this point because the way that the delegates are allocated in this cycle are different from what we've seen in previous ones, particularly because of this proportionality system. There have been many upsets in the history of Democratic primaries, and the Sanders people often look at the examples of, you know, races in the 70s and 80s sort of to say this is a fluid race. It's silly to think that we would finish this early on. But because of the way that the delegates are allocated this time, it's designed to make it more difficult for a late kind of surge.
Now, one thing that has changed as the season has unfolded is the number of Democratic debates. They were kept very tight in the beginning, now expanded. So, Bert Johnson, has that helped either candidate having more Democratic debates?
I think it's helped Sanders to the extent that there's been publicity for these debates because he's been able to stand on the same stage as Hillary Clinton and go toe-to-toe with her over these big issues. Now, although I don't think that the Sanders supporters should be worried about the superdelegates, I do feel like they have a beef about these debates and the times that they were scheduled to make them less visible to a lot of voters.
That's true. We're talking today about the presidential primary so far. Just ahead, we'll look at the states that are in play in the next few weeks. I'm joined by reporter Gabriel DeBenedetti of Politico and Bert Johnson of Middlebury College's Political Science Department. Listeners, what do you think of Bernie Sanders' chances in Florida, Illinois, and Ohio? In your mind, have the additional debates helped or hurt him? And on the Republican side, can anyone stop Donald Trump? Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Rick Singeri, and this is Vermont Edition. It's almost a month and a half since the Iowa caucuses got the presidential race started in earnest. Today, we're sizing up what's taken place since then and looking ahead to the big primaries that are in play in the next few weeks. I'm speaking with Bert Johnson. He's chair of the Middlebury College Political Science Department, and Gabriel DeBenedetti, a reporter with Politico who covers the Democratic presidential candidates. Listeners, we'd love to hear from you. You can call in at 1-800-639-2211, or you can post on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. All right, so let's look ahead to the next big primaries. Tomorrow, the big one. The Democrats in the Northern Mariana Islands hold their convention. Your predictions, gentlemen, go.
No idea.
Yeah.
I
should say this. They almost have as many delegates as Vermont. Vermont has 16. The North Mariana Islands have 11. So let's not take it too lightly, but let's go on to some bigger ones. We'll look first at Florida with 246 delegates in play. Clinton has a strong lead there. Gabriel, why is that?
In Florida specifically, you know, this is a state where she has real institutional advantages. They know her well there. She's been there many, many times, not only in this campaign, but over the last 30 years, going back to when she was living in Arkansas. You know, the Sanders campaign is starting to pay attention to Florida now. He made his first swing there this week. Reality of the situation is that the Sanders campaign knows that he's not going to compete particularly strongly in Florida compared to other places. They're going to try and win some delegates out of there, but I think they would admit, behind closed doors at least, that Clinton is likely to win that one.
There's a strong Jewish vote in South Florida. Does that help him at all, Bert Johnson?
It might a little, but I basically agree with what Gabriel said. I think it's a tough state for the Sanders campaign, and I think they realize that. Now, it doesn't make sense for them to get out entirely because it's proportional, so to the extent that they can make it a little bit closer, they'll try to do that. But they've got to be focusing on states like Ohio.
And I think when he went to the debate this week, it was the first time he touched down in Florida during the entire season, campaign season. So hasn't completely written off Florida, but indeed it is going to be tough for him to take that state. Let's talk to Barbara. She's calling in from Shaftesbury and has a question for us. Barbara, thanks for calling Vermont Edition. What's your question or comment?
Hi. I would just like one of your guests to tell me, how can you convince me that my vote still counts? There is no such thing as a one-person, one vote. Between the delegates, the superdelegates, and the Electoral College, I feel like I am going to vote, but I feel like, why should I even go? Patrick Leahy, who I love, a couple weeks ago said he's a superdelegate and he's voting for Clinton no matter what the popular vote is. Please tell me why I should vote and does it count?
Barbara, excellent question. We're going to start with you, Bert. You're a political science professor. Convince Barbara that her vote still does matter in this presidential election.
Well, I'll do my best. Barbara, your vote does still count. And it is true that we have kind of a convoluted system with things like the Electoral College and superdelegates that seem remote from the average voter. But I think somebody like James Madison would say it all goes back to the individual voter. So that Electoral College vote is determined based on individual votes. And the superdelegates, as we were saying earlier, they tend to come around to what the population votes for. So our system is not a perfect mirror of what the voters in the various states do, but it's a rough approximation of public opinion. So I wouldn't lose hope right yet anyway.
Gabriel, I hear some frustration in Barbara's voice. Are you hearing that elsewhere in the country?
Yeah, absolutely. I think in particular this time around when Senator Sanders has, you know, brought a certain group of voters into the process that have not been, you know, that have not been engaged in the past, including a lot of young voters, there are a lot of people questioning why, in particular on the Democratic side, this superdelegate system is what it is. I think Bert's right, you know, which it all goes back to the individual voter. But it is something that people are talking about more and more, and it's actually something that Senator Sanders says in every single one of his speeches. He says, I believe in one person, one vote. You know, he hasn't made it into a broad campaign effort to fight against the superdelegate system. Perhaps that could come later.
Let's take another call. Will's calling from Windsor. Will, thanks for calling Vermont Edition. What's your question or comment?
Well, just to tack on to what you were just talking about, Nancy Pelosi actually is speaking out against the superdelegate issue. And, you know, all the news outlets were remiss in pointing out that the superdelegates don't really matter until people started talking out about it. And one other thing that's kind of skewed, I believe, is in the primary schedule, all the it was kind of front-loaded in the South. And I don't think that was on purpose or anything, but that's where Hillary's doing really well. It's a low-information area, and it's typically conservative states that aren't really going to matter all that much in the general election anyway. As far as Democratic voting, they're probably not going to win those states anyway. So we got all that's almost out of the way, and then we're heading on to more Sanders territory. So there's a lot more delegates out there in California and New York are very heavily saturated with more delegate votes.
Will makes an excellent point, Bert. You know, it is the primary season. The schedule is heavily weighted to the South early on, Super Tuesday. Does that affect how someone like Bernie Sanders does in the long run, or, you know, do his supporters in the more industrial states just know that they'll get their chance?
Well, at this point, I think they'll get their chance, but Will does make an interesting point about the scheduling, and that dates back to the 1980s when the Democratic Party wanted to place Southern primaries early in the race so that they would make sure that they would nominate someone who was electable nationally. They were concerned that a Northern liberal might win the primaries otherwise and not be electable nationwide. So that is a kind of an interesting quirk of history that the schedule is the way it is, but I would also say that the very early schedule was quite favorable to Bernie Sanders, with Iowa and New Hampshire being a couple of his very, very good states. So there's parts of the schedule that has helped him as well as that have hurt him.
Now, Gabriel, you were here on Super Tuesday. You were at the Bernie Sanders rally that evening. What did you observe here about his connection to the people of Vermont?
Well, I think the way that I have phrased it in the past is I don't think I've ever seen a political rally in which, you know, someone is so adored by the crowd. It's very clear that he is the hometown favorite. It felt more like a homecoming than a political rally. That said, the event ended before Super Tuesday results actually came in for the most part. We knew that he had won Vermont, obviously, but everyone kind of knew that the day was not going to go exactly as planned for him. So he wrapped up early, but it was a really adoring crowd, you know, in a way that we don't necessarily see with other candidates. You know, when Secretary Clinton goes to New York, it's a little bit more of a mixed crowd. And, you know, you see it the same way with Rubio in Miami, for example. You know, he's struggling in Florida right now.
Gabriel, what strategies do you expect from both Sanders and Clinton heading into Tuesday? We got Ohio, Illinois, Missouri up for grabs.
Well, I think what you saw on the Sanders side is that they were really emboldened by the Michigan win, and one thing that they saw was that they think that their argument on multinational trade deals, not necessarily the most the sexiest of topics, but that's one that has really, you know, lit up a certain group of working class voters. They're going to be talking about that a lot, particularly in Ohio and Illinois, places where the auto industry has left or been hurt. They're going to keep fighting this auto bailout fight with Secretary Clinton. And she's in a tough situation because she really wanted to be pivoting to the general election at this point, taking on Donald Trump. But now she's faced with the question, you know, do I have to keep fighting Bernie Sanders?
Listeners, you can join our conversation today on the primary election. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Maggie from Leominster, New Hampshire is calling. Maggie, thanks so much for joining the conversation. What's your question or comment today?
All right. What I had to say is that in talking with some older Republicans and also with some young people, they tell me if they're faced with a choice of voting for Hillary or Donald Trump, they will vote for Donald Trump. If they have a choice of voting Donald Trump or Bernie, they'll vote for Bernie. That's who they really would like to have. So my question is, what does your panel think is going to happen in the general election based on who's the Democratic nominee?
Great question, Maggie. So the polls have shown that Sanders versus Trump, Clinton versus Trump, Bernie Sanders comes out ahead. But this far out, polls that match up a Republican and a Democrat in November, do they carry much weight? Let's start with you, Bert Johnson.
I wouldn't say so. And it's tough to figure out what to make of these polls. And the reason is because Bernie Sanders is not widely known nationally in the same way that Hillary and Donald Trump are widely known. So to have Hillary Clinton up against Donald Trump right now, those are two very known quantities. And Bernie's not well known, and people may give him the benefit of the doubt if they consider that question, would you support Trump or Sanders, as kind of a question like, would you support Trump or someone else? They might just go for the someone else, no matter who it is, but maybe when they learn more about Sanders later, they change their minds. So this is something that it's very tough to predict what the result will be based on polls that are this early.
Gabriel, how much weight do you put in these?
I think that's exactly right. And one thing that the Clinton forces frequently say is, you know, she is someone who has faced for years and years and millions of dollars worth of Republican attacks against her that have aimed to define her. And so she's a very well-known quantity, both the positives and negatives. And that hasn't really happened with Sanders in the national arena. That said, you know, it's important to note that both Clinton and Sanders in these national polls do beat Donald Trump at this point. Again, let's caution that polls this early are very difficult to tell how useful they are, especially because so much is going to change economically, internationally, politically, here, domestically, you know, by the time voting actually begins in November. But the reality of the situation is exactly what Bert said. Senator Sanders is not really a known quantity past parts of the country, and that's changing. But you see these numbers changing as well.
Now, it also appears that Bernie Sanders has been very proud to have moved Hillary Clinton left on a number of issues. First of all, do you see that? Is he successful in doing that? Second of all, is it a nuisance for Clinton to have to continue to tack left longer this far into the primary season, Bert?
I think he has pulled her to the left on some issues, particularly with respect to trade. But I don't necessarily think that hurts her or hurts the party in the long run. It could make her a stronger candidate. It could make her better at responding to attacks. And I think we've seen in the Republican side, too, trade is a big issue there as well. So it may not necessarily take votes away from the Democrats in the general election if they have a polished message on trade.
And Sanders has probably done a much better job at successfully energizing voters compared to Hillary Clinton. So if Bernie loses, does the energized Democratic base fade away? Or will a Trump or Cruz candidacy in the general election keep the Democrats fired up? What do you think, Gabriel?
Well, I think part of it depends on what, if Secretary Clinton is the nominee, she asks Senator Sanders to do and the degree to which he agrees to do it. You know, if he's on the campaign trail for her, he can keep some of these people fired up, though probably not to the same extent as now. That said, we really don't know what the Democratic base is going to be feeling if it goes up against a Cruz or a Trump. By all indication, these are two Republican candidates who really do scare a lot of Democratic voters, and you have to think the entire Democratic Party machine, Clinton and otherwise, will be mobilizing in order to get these people out to the polls to vote against a Cruz or a Trump. These are not traditional candidates. It is not a traditional race that we're looking at here. But again, Senator Sanders will play some sort of role, whether by silence or by being on the trail for Clinton, if she is the nominee.
Bert, what do you think his role might be if, I'm just saying, if he loses and Hillary Clinton gets the Democratic nomination?
Well, I think Gabriel's right. He will play some role. I doubt that he would be the vice presidential nominee, as some people are suggesting. But he would play some role on the campaign trail, and certainly his supporters would be a group that the Clinton campaign would be trying to appeal to. But I would point out that historically, even if there are divisions within the party like this in the primary race, 90% of Democrats vote for the Democrat and 90% of Republicans vote for the Republican nominee. So I think to the extent that there's any uncertainty about that fact, this election is going to be on the Republican side because there's a lot of Republicans who have deep misgivings about Donald Trump. Those people who supported Sanders will go over to Clinton just in the same way that the Clinton supporters went over to Obama in 2008.
All right, let's look at the Republican side. They've become more aggressive over the past couple of weeks in attacking frontrunner Donald Trump. Gabriel, does this do anything to erode his popularity or slow him down?
Erode his popularity, I'm not sure. Slow him down remains to be seen. You know, he's still winning a lot of states. Polls still show him leading in almost all of the March 15th, next Tuesday, states. What you've seen, though, is you've seen other Republicans trying to be more tactical about taking him down. You know, you saw just before we came on, Marco Rubio's spokesman saying, if you want to stop Trump, you should vote for John Kasich in Ohio. And that's absolutely remarkable to see candidates saying you should vote for the other one. So there is obviously a movement to try and stop him. It has not worked yet, and that's just the truth that Republicans are trying to deal with.
At what point does the Republican Party or the RNC coalesce around Donald Trump as its candidate, and how do they do it, Bert?
Well, I'm not sure. You saw Reince Priebus right before the debate last night issuing a call for unity almost plaintively. It's hard to tell what's going to happen. I think if Trump wins either Florida or Ohio on Tuesday, it's almost all over, and the other candidates really have to think about either a very far-fetched brokered convention scenario, or whether they're going to rally around Trump, or whether they're going to join a third-party effort or something of that nature. This is really something that I certainly haven't seen in U.S. politics in my lifetime, so I don't know what to base any kind of prediction on.
Let's flesh out a scenario, where the Republican candidate in November is not Donald Trump. Gabriel, how does it happen?
How do the Republicans get to a scenario when Donald Trump is not the nominee? Basically, at this point, they have to split all of the rest of the races in a way that allows them to get into the convention this summer without anyone having having reached the delegate threshold. Then at the convention, they have to figure out a way to get another candidate past that delegate threshold, and that could take a long, long time. So the reality is there's no one else at this point who can, realistically speaking, reach who is likely to reach that threshold that would clinch them the nomination other than Trump. It's still possible for the other candidates, but they would have to start winning the rest of these races by such a high margin so quickly that something would have to change drastically. And while this has been a very, shocking presidential race in many, many ways, that might be one step too far.
I'm going to switch back to Bernie Sanders one last time, because he has this funding model, small contributions, seems to make him immune to one of the normal problems of a campaign. That's when the big money dries up after a bad result. So, Bert, does that keep him in the race with this funding model that he has with the small contributions?
I think yes. As long as he's got an energized base, after he won Michigan, he raised something like $5 million again. So he's got the money to keep on going. So I would expect him to do that. It's interesting to note in this race that all the predictions about the effect of money in politics notwithstanding, the two candidates who have been the biggest surprises have been Trump and Sanders, and neither one of them is operating on the conventional fundraising model.
Wow, excellent point. That's Bert Johnson. He's chair of the Middlebury College Political Science Department. He's also, with his colleague Matt Dickinson, one of the professor pundits. They have a series of videos they are producing about the presidential primary. We have the latest installment of Professor Pundits on our website, vpr.net/Vermont Edition. We also heard today from Gabriel Debitadetti. He is a reporter with Politico, who covers the Democratic presidential candidates. I want to thank both of you for joining us today.
Thank
Great
you.
To
and coming up, an apple orchard in winter is a lonely place, especially for the tree pruners who do most of their work in the coldest months. We'll learn more just ahead. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Bob Kinzel. Apples are closely identified with the fall season, and the blossoms on apple trees that emerge in spring also leave a strong impression. But what about the life of an apple orchard in winter? At the Kent Ridge Orchard, just west of Middlebury, tree pruner Blake Harrison sees winter as a crucial season. He says good winter pruning ensures that trees can bloom in spring and yield a good harvest in the fall. VPR's partner podcast, Wintery Mix, visited Harrison in the orchard in January to learn more. Here's an excerpt on that episode with host Alex Kaufman.
Hey, Alex.
How's it going, Blake?
Not bad. Welcome to Kent Ridge Orchard.
Thank you very much. What's the footprint of this thing?
Oh, there's about 30 acres in trees. Nice views, too.
Is that a lot?
No, that's really comparatively small.
Introduce me to the Kent Ridge Orchard, if you can.
All right, well, this orchard, like I said, has been here a long time. I don't know how long it's been here, but it was part of a whole series of orchards that ran this ridge from north to south, facing east, looking down at the town of Middlebury. This was all orchards at one point in time, all the way down through Cornwall, starting up here in Weybridge and extending down through Cornwall. And a lot of those have been broken up now and turned into housing, but this is a remnant of that. So it's been here a long time. It was owned by a professor at the college for a number of years, as I understand it, and then the gentleman who owns it now bought it maybe 10 years ago.
And is there something specific about this aspect of land or type of land that makes it good for having an orchard?
Orchards like sloped land for drainage, and we're obviously on a hillside here, so there's benefit to that. There's also benefit to being a little bit higher in elevation, not too high, but a little bit higher. Cold air drains down in the springtime, and that can have beneficial effects during a time when the blossoms are forming.
So when you walk into an orchard, when does the pruning season typically start? Is it a step-by-step process, or do you just do one tree all the way till it's done and move on?
Well, that's a good question. A lot of people do it different ways. There's no exact right way to prune, and you get 10 people together. If they could do the same tree 10 times over, it would look different for each person. I typically do a group of trees. I use about maybe 5 different tools in the course of doing a tree. I typically do a group of trees with one tool, and then I grab the next tool. I go back through those trees, and I do a different kind of cut with that tool, and then I grab the next tool, and I do a different kind of cut with that tool. So I usually work in groups of maybe 10 trees. I'll get about 10 done, and I'll keep passing by with different tools. So the benefit for me is that different tools tax different muscles and different joints, and so during the course of a day, if I used just the same tool over and over and over again, I'd feel pretty sore in certain places. But distributing the soreness and the aches and pains across a bunch of different tools is really beneficial.
Well, let's step over here, and I'll get you back to work here, and I'll ask you a few questions while you're
sure,
poking along.
Let's walk this stuff over. We're going about 5 rows over. Just watch your step. A lot of people, when I tell them I prune, I think they kind of picture pruning roses or something, you know, going around with a pair of loppers. But this is a really, really physically demanding, intense job.
So just list for me what we have here for tools.
Okay. If I were to prune this tree, the first tool I would use would be a chainsaw. And I'd go through and make just a few big cuts to get rid of some problem limbs that are a little bit bigger. So now I go through with my handsaw, which I keep on my belt just in case I need it. And we'll pull out all this stuff we just cut. And that all gets thrown into the middle of the row. All that out. And then I go through and zip off a bunch of things like that. Always looking for suckers. Little tiny things that, you know.
Yeah, explain a sucker.
Well, that's a fast-growing, mostly vertical little growth like this that oftentimes or typically will grow out of a former cut. Get that thing and get rid of this one. But it's got this kind of funny thing in the middle. Never gets any sun. But there's buds on it.
There's fruit on it. Is there any reason you use the handsaw instead of the loppers for a lot of these little guys?
You know, I think the handsaw gives a better cut.
Yeah.
Then I go around with these hand loppers, just like you may have in your backyard, a classic set of hand loppers. And I do just a quick pass around and get some of the smaller stuff from down low that I didn't get with my handsaw. Just cutting limbs. You make a lot of decisions just kind of on the fly. But that's probably good for that whole section right there. You can maybe do something else with the pole pruner. Being on the ground gives, I think, a better perspective on the tree than when you're up there in it. You're not seeing the whole picture, I think. And it's a lot faster to work on the ground, I think, than to move a ladder around, especially when there's a lot of snow. So I love the pole saw. That was a dead piece that had to go. This is kind of coming off at a pretty ugly angle, so it's like a 4-year-old branch. It probably should have been cut years ago, but you gotta watch out. They come down hard sometimes.
It looks like you got pretty good control of where they're going to fall.
Yeah. You know, the thing about apple trees is there's a lot of places for a branch to get hung up on its way down.
Yeah.
And so typically they don't fall straight down. There's, you know, something that catches it. But every now and again you do get caught. Just before you got here, I got hit in the lip by something that came down. But yeah, they typically fall about where you want them to fall.
Your triceps must just be...
You get kind of big shoulders. Yeah, it's sort of an incredible Hulk transformation every winter where, a lot of the rest of the year I spend, this is the pole pruner, a lot of the rest of the year I spend on a tractor doing various things, so I'm less active than I am this time of year. These trees are, I don't know, well over 50 years old, some of them. But there's other ones that are younger that have been interplanted in between them.
and we're looking at basically a row of limbs that you've done down here, I would venture to say maybe 300 yards of it. How do you pick that up?
That gets pushed out with a tractor and put into piles like that one and ultimately burned. Different orchards have different ways of dealing with that, with brush like that. But that's what we do here. It'll all get pushed out. These trees, were kind of neglected for a number of years. So in recent years, as they've been sort of brought back into production, there were bigger piles between the rows because there was more stuff coming out of them, more limbs coming out of them. So this is a pretty modest and reasonable amount of brush left over from pruning. These trees are getting back into shape where they need to be. When I say I could do 30 acres, I should probably clarify that a little bit. This orchard's different from other orchards in that there's 30 acres planted, let's say, in trees, but these rows are really, really wide. And it's an old-fashioned, sort of inefficient orchard by modern standards. 30 acres of trees in a denser planting would be a lot more trees, and that would be a bigger challenge.
And the length of your season is basically when the leaves fall to when they come back on, or is it shorter than that?
Well, you can prune pretty much any time of year, but you don't typically do this kind of pruning during the growing season. Some people say maybe you shouldn't prune so much in November. I've heard that before. I typically don't really get started till around Christmas time. There's other activities to do that keep me busy until then, and then from that point on, it's pretty much pruning till really end of April or so, and then there's other jobs, that seasonal work that has to get done, and whatever pruning doesn't get done at that point doesn't get done.
It seems like there's kind of probably a disconnected community of folks that do exactly what you do. Do you ever cross paths with them and network or things like that?
That's a really good point. It's kind of lonely out here. I work alone. I don't have any other people that help prune, at least this year. I have in the past a little bit, but no, there's no forum, let's say, for a pruning comparison. It would be nice. I think everybody would benefit by looking at other people's pruning, but some of the bigger orchards have multiple guys doing this, and they get to, I'm sure, talk about things. For me, it's just a lot of it's just trial and error. If you stay with certain trees for long enough, you can see the mistakes that you made in past years, something that didn't work, or you try something in a
trial and error could take a decade.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's part of the business. You see what works and what doesn't, and then you have to go back and correct it later. And these trees have had, because they were abandoned, there's been a multi-stage progress in bringing them back. And I've left a lot of stuff over the years in these trees that anybody driving by who knows anything about pruning probably wondered why it was left there. But if you don't prune for a number of years, let's say 3 or 4 years, you're going to regret it because there's a lot of worthless wood in there that's got to get cut out. But the owner of this orchard's committed to making it work, and with a market for cider, there's a possibility that, you know, that this kind of place can not only survive but thrive.
And I would assume, I mean, in the last 5 years, it's kind of like IPAs and ciders have kind of taken over the world, right?
That's right.
Has that changed anything drastically, either for you or for Vermont, as you know it, in the orchard industry, as far as the takeoff of cider locally and nationally?
Yeah, there's different orchards are experimenting with planting different varieties that may not have market value beyond cider. So, you know, varieties that you wouldn't necessarily want to eat, not dessert variety apples, but ones that are particularly good for making cider. So a lot of orchards are experimenting with planting varieties that, you know, that'll be more marketable to the cider industry. But, of course, that takes time. You know, you put them in the ground last year, you still got 5 years or so before you really know what you're going to get. So you're committed to these individual trees. You can't just rip them up. It's not like a cornfield where you cut it all down and you plant it to something new the next year. If pumpkins are worth more than corn, you can change your field over from year to year, but you can't do that with an orchard. Once it's in place, there's an incentive to maintain it and to keep it going.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's just worthless and you got to sell it and subdivide it.
Yeah, and rip up all the trees, and you hate to see that happen. So I'm thankful for, you know, the boom in cider, because it's created a market for these and it's helping to protect some of these old orchards.
So you probably enjoy winters that have less snow?
This has been particularly good this year. It's really been nice. I like it when the ground's frozen. You know, it's less slippery and less muddy. But with less snow, it's always better. I mean, last year when I was in this exact section here, there was a couple feet of snow on the ground. And you know, you basically take a couple of steps and you know, lift your legs high, a couple steps, plant yourself there, and then you work from that spot for as long as you can, and then you take a couple steps, and it was a real slog. And I'm finding that the trees I did in this section when the snow was so deep aren't done as well as they should have been.
Blake, thank
Alex.
You, sir.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I
my
now
pleasure.
Feel more educated about something I've probably seen for, you know, my entire 36 years on this planet, driving by orchards in the wintertime, having no idea.
Well, the key to remember is the stuff that happens here in the wintertime makes everything else possible, and people tend to forget that. You go to an orchard to see the blossoms in the spring, you go to pick apples in the fall, but it's really this time of year that's really making all that possible.
That's apple tree pruner Blake Harrison at Kent Ridge Orchard near Middlebury. He talked with Alex Kaufman, host of the podcast Wintery Mix. This was just an excerpt of a longer interview. You can listen to the full story and download other episodes. You can find Wintery Mix in VPR's podcast directory at vpr.net. Monday is 3/14/16, and that makes it Pi Day, as in the mathematical character pi equals 3.1416. That means we'll be putting on our party hats to celebrate math on Monday's Vermont edition, because we rarely get that chance. It'll be a day of chaos theory, differential equations, and discussions about what local mathematicians are working on. If you've got some math research to share, we're all ears. Send it to VPR or Vermont Edition at vpr.net, and then listen Monday at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Anna St. Marie. Mary Williams directed the program, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. Bob Kinzel will be back next Friday. I'm Rick Singeri. Have a great weekend.